With that, I'd like to introduce Norm Groot to speak about the timing and also our first panel. And our panel will be made up of Jocelyn Bridson. She's the Director of Environmental Science and Resources at Rio Farms, based in King City. And Mark Mason. And Mark Mason is the farm manager with Huntington Farms, and they farm up and down the Salinas Valley.
All right. Thank you, Abby. Well, thank you.
Ms. Olson, please start the timer. 30 minutes. Thank you.
Real quick about the timing, we have spaced out our time for all the panels so that we make sure that we have all time for presentations today. And I do have some cards here that I will be showing to our panelists as well as you as we approach the end of each panel session so that we know where we're at timing-wise. Thank you.
All right. Without further ado, thank you, board members, for taking the time to listen to perspective from agriculture. Mark and I will cover a little bit about irrigation practices and then hopefully elaborate more on what we've got going on. So overall, we just wanted some of our objectives. We know that we need to ensure that we are protecting water quality through our practices. It is a privilege to own and rent and operate on a lot of land, and we know that. We know that we are using water and we are using nutrients, and we have to work with you. It's our common goal to really meet these objectives. But it's very important to know that how we reach those goals, it's unique to each farm. So whether the soil type is different from farm A to B or topography, we've got a lot of unique characteristics in our region. Farmers must be aware of the crop's root zone and how they can be more efficient in their irrigation. Most scientists, CCAs, know exactly how deep the roots go, and growers are starting to understand that through more education. Fortunately, we're blessed with a diversity of crops, and with deep-rooted plants that harvest that nitrogen from deep down, as well as shallow-rooted crops. So we actually are doing a pretty good job, and we don't have a monocrop here, so we've got that to thank for some of our practices and nitrogen harvesting of the soil. Our trends do show that we're using more BMPs, leading to less runoff, as evidenced by the low flows that Preservation Inc. has been finding. Even not considering the drought years, they've been finding lower irrigation runoff, and that is the key to reducing our impact on surface water quality. Another point that we want to make is that a crop in one area may need more water than in other areas. I'm not sure where everybody here lives, but if you live near the coast, it's cooler, foggy. If you live inland, Paso Robles, King City, you know that it's hot. We can have a range of 20 degrees in the same day. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then what we really want to focus on with the staff and working with the board is making sure that we set out a publicly available methodology for how outliers will be determined. We need to understand how these budgets are being created. We've seen TNA data analysis in the past that has relied on some assumptions that actually were misinformed and potentially even false. So we want to make sure that you consider regional characteristics and you make that process publicly available, as any true scientific report should be. So I don't know, Mark, do you want to comment on this slide here?
Yeah, so this is showing the trend in irrigation methods. And what we're trying to show here is that over time we have reduced our irrigation, reduced our use of sprinkler pipe and adopted more drip irrigation. So drip has been a huge water saver for us, and it's allowed us to do things like germinate crops now with drip tape, where we get almost no runoff. So drip tape is an advantage something that we're using to help reduce our water, and that's what this slide is trying to show here.
And this slide is just reiterating some of those acres. So on about 200,000 acres in the Salinas Valley, we are reporting our water use to the county and have been since 1995. And over 75% of our acres are 150,000 acres. We've got pressure gauges. We have flow meters on them on half of our acres. We are looking at BMPs, like reducing our leakage, fixing pipes, that type of thing, and not irrigating when it's windy. And then at least on a quarter of the acres, 50,000 acres, land leveling, which greatly reduces surface water runoff, using those micro-irrigation sprinkler systems or drip systems, I should say, and reducing our sprinkler use. And I think for the most part, we've entirely eliminated furrow irrigation, which we know has significant losses for evaporation. It's a very high water use, and it also has the potential for surface water runoff. So we've, for the most part, in the Central Coast region, I'm not aware of anyone that still furrow irrigates. It can be done, but efficiently. But so far, we've mostly moved towards sprinklers and drip irrigation. So there are lots of reasons why growers irrigate, and I know I actually just got into farming about 6 years ago. My background's in the environment and conservation, and I would ask a lot of questions of why are you irrigating when there's nothing in the field? Well, there are seeds in the ground. If you go back, way back to plant biology, you remember the seed coat is very hard for a lot of plants, and unless if it's fire germinated and needs fire to break that, it typically needs water. Okay, so that's, you know, one example of why we're irrigating. It looks like nothing's out there. We have to keep that seed coat wet all the time. So that's pre-irrigation also. If you've ever bought a plant at Home Depot and want to plant it in your dusty backyard, you realize it's probably better to wet your soil first. Well, that's exactly what we have to do before we put in our crops as well, especially if we had a very dry winter, and especially if it's April before we start planting. So those are some reasons why we're irrigating. The salt leaching fraction. So we grow a lot of sensitive and moderately sensitive crops that are sensitive to salt. Lettuce is a moderately sensitive crop. I'll talk about that in a bit. But we have to irrigate not just to what the crop needs based on the climate, but also what it needs based on the salt content of the water. So we might have to irrigate a little bit more than what the typical crop would require. And, of course, crop growth. So, obviously, we need to grow the crop throughout its life. Frost control, this is used sometimes in wineries to prevent the entire crop from getting lost and getting damaged. When we talk about AR ratios, you have to think if you don't have anything removed, then you've got a real problem. So we have to apply a little bit more water in order to harvest something. And then harvest. A lot of times growers, believe it or not, they don't control the harvest decisions. So a harvest company might say, yeah, I don't want that lettuce this week. I want it next week. Or that spinach needs another shot of water because it's looking a little limp and it needs to be, you know, harvested and survive. we harvest it, you know, 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. and it's already getting hot. If you've ever had a spinach salad out on a picnic, you know it's going to wilt pretty quickly. Well, same idea in the field, except that's your bank account out on the field. Okay, so we might pre-irrigate right before the harvest as well. Do you have any other commentary on that, Mark?
No, the harvest, a lot of times, like she said, it's really out of our control, and the harvest companies sometimes will ask us to keep fields fresh. They'll hold them in a bad market like we're currently having. They'll continue to ask for water to hold fields. And, you know, that's pretty important because it really doesn't have any – it's not really our call or our input into that. You know, that's somebody else's decision.
Great. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the nitrogen and well water and soil. It is important for growers to use those numbers, but we're going to talk a little bit about how the nitrogen in the well water, it's actually being recycled from the groundwater onto the land and then back down again. And it's also important for growers to take quick nitrate tests or other soil tests with nitrogen. Our company was one of the first that started using it back in 1997, I believe, and every year we take hundreds of tests. We do that pre-plant. We do it mid-season. We do it after a harvest just to see what we're leaving behind. It's a tool, but it's not technically a new source of nitrogen. It's reflecting what's already in the soil. So I just wanted to make that point that while we do use these as tools, it's not necessarily an applied source of nitrogen. It's a kind of a cycling source, and it's already there in the field. And then I guess the last point here is that we don't have all of our historic nitrogen, both in the soil and the well water. It is available for the plant if the plant is picking up the nitrogen in that phase of growth. But you don't want to double count it, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. So this is just a we needed some sort of animation to wake you guys up. So this is just showing and the new versus old nitrogen or cycling. I like to call it cycling nitrogen. But new nitrogen was brought up in Ag Order 3.0 under the Irrigation Nutrient Management Plan section. And what that said was growers need to report nitrogen applied, new nitrogen applied. Because if you're going to set the benchmark at including that nitrogen that's already in the water, we're getting kind of blamed for something that we're already getting blamed for. So it's getting double counted in some ways. So it doesn't really result in additional loading to the aquifer. The other aspect of our water, as I mentioned, the seeds need water to germinate, but the seed doesn't need the nitrogen in the water. But you're going to count that nitrogen in the water. So if we start thinking about separating out that old nitrogen from the water and not including it in the AR reporting metrics, you start to see that you're not running into that issue, because maybe for half of the season, in the middle to the late part of that growing season, the crop is picking up nitrogen. That's when it wants it. But at the beginning, it still needs the water, but it doesn't actually take up the nitrogen in the water. And I know this is probably devil in the details, but it's true, because as growers are going to be graded on our AR metrics and are we an outlier, we need to make sure that we can use our high nitrogen water and we can pump that without being punished for it, if that makes sense. And this was written also in the East San Joaquin order. We want to incentivize growers to use this high nitrogen water, but we need to think of it as different because we're actually cycling the same water. Do you have any other comment on that one?
Yeah, I was just going to comment on the using the nitrogen to grow the crop out of the groundwater. Some of the difficulties of it is, it's, number one, it's not consistently at the same number. It may change throughout the year, so we can't definitely depend upon a certain amount of fertilizer. And then we also, on large ranches, will blend water. So we've got a high nitrate well that may blend. We might have a series of six or seven wells on one ranch that can all be blended based on what the cropping pattern is, whether we have transplants going in or crop being harvested. So we never really know what we're going to get because we don't know how it's going to be blended. So it's hard to depend upon the in and the groundwater 100%, but we're figuring it out. We're working to try to figure out how to make that work. That's my comment on that.
And I'll just add one more thing. When I was talking about the N uptake of plants, this was actually reflected in the work by Dr. Michael Kahn. He only studied nitrogen uptake in plants after drip was installed for all of the studies that he did. So he didn't count the pre-irrigation. He didn't count sprinkler germination water. He only counted after drip was installed. And again, so he did find a high percentage of that nitrogen can be used, but he only studied about half of the plant cycle. The beginning half of the water he didn't analyze. So I think, you know, it's a very small part of the study, a couple sentences in each one, but that's a very important part of agronomy that we have to think about when we're looking at AR budgets and outlier determination. The other aspect, or one more aspect, is, as I mentioned, I work at Rio Farms in King City, and we're sensitive when people say, oh, you're overwatering. A lot of times we're watering exactly to what the required crop evapotranspiration is. So in King, this shows the monthly average evapotranspiration, and this is from Sima stations in the Monterey Bay region, all of them. And you can see King City there is the red line on top. And what this shows, let's just say in July, is King City requires 7.5 inches of irrigation for the reference evapotranspiration. That's to water well-watered grass. It takes 7.5 inches on average in July. For Castroville, it takes about 4.8. So that's about, I believe that's about 61% higher in King City in the month of July. Taken as an average over the year, King City is 40% higher average evapotranspiration. So in the future, when you get reports of, well, you know, growers should only be applying this amount of water, 2 acre feet of water, everything else is excessive, we have to say, well, wait a second, you know, did you look at the climate zone? Are you considering what crop type it is, for example? That's another question. Even though vegetables is a category, celery takes more water than a lettuce, for example. So when we talk about in the future learning from staff, what do the TNA reports say, we need to understand what were the assumptions that were made. And we bring this up because we did a public records request back in May, I believe, about a TNA analysis that was presented to your board. And we asked for the methodology behind that because it was reported that you know, thousands of pounds of nitrogen were going to surface waters. Well, we found out this, the assumption was any grower that applies more than 2 acre feet per crop is overwatering. And we said, and therefore that water is runoff that reaches the water body of the state. So the assumption could be incorrect if they are in a higher ET zone, if they're applying the correct amount because it's a crop that requires more water. Potentially that doesn't reach a surface water body. Maybe it leaches instead because it's not hydrologically connected. So all of these things are assumptions that were kind of hidden that weren't part of the presentation to you. And so I just wanted to say in the future, we growers would appreciate potentially even having a technical advisory committee or science panel that helps the regional board before they make reports to come up with a methodology to do things like this, to look at ETO. So this just shows a crop requiring, you know, 1.25 acre feet of water in Castroville may need 3.2 acre feet in King City. That's a pretty extreme event, but that is how the data, what the data shows from CIMAS. So again, if you make comparisons, if you want to say grower A is good and B is bad, you hopefully will be incorporating some of these climate differences. And this is an example as well, as was previously mentioned, for leaching requirement, the amount of salts in the water. Lettuce is moderately sensitive. Let's just say lettuce needs 12 inches of water or a foot of water in Castroville. So what we have, I don't know if this does the pointer work. Yes. So in Castroville, the line should be on top of this bar, but in Castroville it needs 12 inches. Even with perfect water that's not salty, it needs 18 inches in King City, which is right over here. Now, if we increase the salt content of the water, let's say we go up to 2 decisiemens per meter, that means in Castroville, instead of it just needing 12 inches, it needs 22 inches, or 180% of the normal crop evapotranspiration. And in King City, if we've got salty water, it needs 32 inches. And all of these are technically agronomically correct for the grower. And this is reality. And actually, reality goes off the charts. Growers can have a 3.0 decisiemens per meter and sometimes up to 4.0, in which case you're literally farming off the charts. I've talked to UC professionals, and they've suggested never go above 200%. So that's why I didn't go above 200%. We're at 180% here. So I want to use caution again in the future. If you say, well, you only need 12 inches of water for lettuce, say, well, let's consider, you know, consider the, number one, the climate zone, consider a leaching fraction. And I haven't even mentioned the distribution uniformity, which could be 70%, 75% for sprinklers and 85%, 90% for drip. Okay. We'll keep rolling here. Yeah.
Can you go back to the prior slide?
Sure.
Yeah, just for clarity, EC?
EC is, the EC is electrical conductivity of the water, which is the total of all of the salts in the irrigation water.
Can you go over those three factors that affect what we're talking about? You mentioned climate zone, uniformity, and leaching. Can you mention those again?
Sure. The climate zone, or the reference evapotranspiration, which is CIMIS is one source of that information, but you could get that from National Weather Service or other resources. You could find zone maps online as well if you wanted to compare growers within the same ET zone. Leaching requirement or leaching fraction, that's the salts in the irrigation water. And then I also mentioned distribution uniformity, or you could just call it irrigation efficiency. So how uniform is the water put over the land? So an idea would be if you're creating outliers based at least on water use is to consider what climate zone they're in. Or, you know, we have already existing hydrologic subareas from different maps that are existing. You could consider county boundaries, water districts, ET data. As I mentioned, that's climate data. You might also want to consider soil type. We have groundwater subbasins now under SGMA, and you could also consider cropping systems. These are all different ways or lenses to look at water use, but we just wanted to let, you know, kind of raise the red flag of water use is going to be very difficult to fairly compare grower to grower.
Yeah, I have just one question. You raised the question of new nitrogen versus old nitrogen, that if, for example, you're watering to prepare the field or you're watering for germination to give the seed the required moisture, that depending on the nitrogen content of the well water, you may be applying nitrogen, but it is nitrogen that is physically impossible to be uptaken. Is that a word? Uptaked. On the other hand, it seems kind of counterintuitive to say that when you're watering in the period when plants are uptaking nitrogen, that you would not count the nitrogen in the water because, and I understand the problems that were raised with blending and that's something that growers are working on. But it seems counterintuitive to not count that nitrogen and somewhat unfair when you're looking at growers that have dramatically different amounts of nitrogen in their well water. So when you suggest that we should not be counting the nitrogen, the old nitrogen, as you called it, would you be suggesting then that the nitrogen in the applied water be counted at some times and not at others? Be counted, for example, not counted during field prep and germination, but counted during the actual growing cycle?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think one thing that staff has done a good job at in the past is presenting total nitrogen applied data. This is with irrigation water, this is without, and that could continue in the future if you wanted to include a portion of the irrigation water in your analysis. I think it would be more fair if you wanted to include it to only count about half that irrigation water, the part where the plant's uptaking it. Should the grower count it? I think the growers need to start accounting for it because studies are showing that during that nitrogen uptake in the plant cycle, they can use it. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it is already in the groundwater and then we're reapplying it. So in the total, in final reports when we think about, well, what is the total new loading or new nitrogen that you're actually entering into this box? It's not a new source. It's getting cycled back from the groundwater up on top. So is it important for growers? Yes. But is it truly reflective of a new source? Not exactly. And then I wanted to mention, because we took a slide out about the soil, soil tests are absolutely important for growers, but it's also not a new source. I'll give you an example. I'm a grower. I apply 100 pounds of nitrogen 3 weeks later to my lettuce. 3 weeks later, I take a soil sample. I find I have 50 pounds left. It's in the soil. Great. I decide to apply 25 more pounds because I think I need it. How many pounds did I apply? 100 plus 50 plus 25 is 175. That's incorrect. I didn't apply that 50. It was already applied in that fertilizer. I applied 100 plus 25. I applied 125 pounds, and that soil test reflected what I applied. Same thing for a pre-plant fertilizer. So I applied 200 pounds to my celery crop A. I harvested it. A month later, I test the soil. There's 25 pounds left. So then I plant. I do my next round, and I apply 150 pounds to the next crop. It doesn't mean I applied 150 plus 25. That 25 remaining in the soil was remaining from that celery. So when we're doing the total, you know, what are we loading to the groundwater, what is the problem here, we have to really consider that what's in the soil is reflecting what was applied already. It's not a new source.
Okay. As a courtesy, I held off a timer, but at this rate, we're going to be here quite late. So what I would like to request from my colleagues, if you have a very short clarification, you know, this is the opportunity to ask. If you have a question that may require a more extended answer, possibly is to hold this to, you know, the end of the presentation. And again, I'm trying to do this in respect of all the other speakers coming. So thank you. So timer back on, please.
We're almost done. So so this next slide just goes to the East San Joaquin order of the guidance from the State Water Board saying it's important to look at a smaller resolution rather than comparing all growers in the region or creating a metric for all growers of what is an outlier. So it points to looking at the township level. You know, obviously you've got some discretion if you want to look at a bigger level, but I think it's an interesting fact that the State Water Board does want, you know, the spatial resolution to be at a pretty small level. So, you know, I think these are some of our objectives that we stated in the beginning. Mark, do you want to talk through these just for fun?
Okay, yeah. So, you know, as far as working towards I'm sorry. Okay, yeah. So I'll just go down to some of the BMPs that we're working on. You know, it's all the ranches are different. They're different layouts. They're different slopes. There's a lot of different things that we might do on different ranches to try to reduce tailwater runoff. But we work on them. We use grading of roads. We have tailwater treatment areas. So there's a lot of BMPs that were best management practices that we're coming up with to try to reduce some of this tailwater. To explain some of the what I call tailwater treatment areas is we might have where we get runoff of a field from irrigation, and instead of just letting the water go leave the ranch or go towards the river, we'll actually contain this tailwater. It'll be a vegetative area. Maybe depends on what our food safety department will allow us to do, but we will contain this tailwater, and we call it a tailwater treatment area. It's one thing that we've kind of developed on our own. Other than that, I don't have anything else to comment on that.
So we've already talked a little bit about these points. And I guess I will say, you know, just to reiterate, would hope that the regional board and your board, the staff and board, will recognize that growers do have some information that is valuable. A lot of us have certified crop advisors working for us. We encourage you to discuss with other professionals when you're coming up with reports in the future. I know Mark Cady's here from CDFA. Maybe he could lend a hand, or the RCDs. Just potentially creating a science advisory panel or a technical assistance provider panel, maybe to meet quarterly or twice a year when you're coming out with templates and instructions, and before they create presentations for your board, so that we can make sure the methodology of how we identify outliers and present the total nitrogen applied data is actually correct, or correct to the best that we can be, because growers are using a lot of their time and effort to get these numbers into staff, and we want to make sure that we get the best possible science out of it rather than forgetting about different factors that might make actual agronomic sense and truly is based in science. So that's why we are here. Any questions? I guess that's for the board to.
You have one more speaker, right?
Not for this panel. We've got next up is the nutrient panel. And then, yeah, how much more time? We have 5 minutes left, so.
Okay, I'll start on my left. Do we have any question at this time?
Chair, tell me if you think this is the right time to make sure everyone understands the new N versus the old N. I'm just a little confused about that point. I kind of understand the concept, but I could use a little more clarification. But it might take 5 minutes, 10 minutes. So I don't know if this is the right time to take that kind of time.
And I feel the same way. It's a discussion I'd like to also have. And if we don't have enough time, maybe the chair would like to tell us when we could engage in that discussion, especially with Jocelyn.
Yeah, maybe later, if we have some clarification which requires a staff input, and I'm making eye contact with Mr. Rose, maybe we could consolidate those, unless, Mr. Robertson, you find appropriate to do it now.
No, I actually think the next panel is the nutrient panel, right?
Yes.
That might be the post that presentation might be the time to discuss that.
Yeah, we could discuss it
then. Well, let's do it that way, and then, you know, we could have staff give a brief refresher. So thank you for asking that. Anything else on your side?
No, that addresses my concern.
Okay. On my right.
I just want to say thank you for being here. Appreciate the information. Thanks for your time.
All right. So thank you, and appreciate also your your efforts in keeping the presentation in a timely fashion. So at this time, nutrient management.
Chair Wolf, with your indulgence, I think we should look at maybe doing timing a little differently. As we have the clerk timing the speakers themselves and pausing during questions, our panels were set up for presentation time plus allowances for questions. And so I think I will time the entire panel, including the question time, and then when we get close to 5 minutes to the end of the allowed time for that panel, I'll hold up my card. I think that makes more sense than trying to judge exactly how many times we have left for questions during the panels.
Okay. The indulgence, it will be based on keeping ourselves on schedule so we don't take time away from the other speakers. Okay. Yes.
May I ask a kind of overall clarifying question? I'm looking at the staff report, and I see a series of speakers in a particular order, and I note that the first two speakers were listed in a second topic, not the first topic. And I don't So now I'm a little bit, thank you, disoriented as to timing per panel. So maybe, Mr. Groot, you could either announce at the beginning of each panel, because it seems like the organization has been very carefully orchestrated or choreographed. So, you know, I would like to understand how you're doing this, because clearly what we've got in front of us is not giving us the map.
Okay, so what we did is we took the amount of time for the full day, divided it up between our panels based on presentation time, and then built in allowances for questions from yourselves. So for this next panel, we have 42 minutes, 30 minutes of presentation with 12 minutes of questions included.
Okay, so that would be, I think that would be important. As each new panel comes up, if you could give us your timing, and that way we are all on the same page.
So I'm going to ask, Norm's talking to Chris right now.
Yeah.
I was going to ask Norm a question that I think will help clarify.
Okay. Thank you.
So Norm, I'm going to ask you a question. Norm, so would you name the last panel that just went, Jocelyn's panel? That was the irrigation panel, right? Okay. So does that help, Dr. Hunter, that they flipped the sequence right there? The irrigation panel went in front of the nutrient panel.
Right, and if in our staff report, note it's that nutrient, irrigation, and pesticide management, and all those speakers are listed as one group. So that's
right.
My
right.
Kind of trying to understand what you finally landed on. I appreciate the fact that as you organize your panels, you know, often the refinements in finalizing how the sequence and the discussion and the logic and so forth. I understand how that occurs, but for us, we're looking at a different organization, so I just want to be clear.
My apologies for that. We did originally start with a food safety panel, and we flipped the presentations around because it made sense after we had the irrigation and nutrient management panels. So
right.
I apologize for the confusion. I think we're still on time.
Yeah, no. But I think I'm the one that's confused, but fine. Thank you.
Okay.
And, Chair, I didn't catch the name of the gentleman that was with Jocelyn at the previous presentation. Mark Mason. Thank you.
All right. Please continue.
Thank you, and good morning. I'm Tim Burrell. I'm the production manager with Blanco Farms. Along with me on the nutrient management panel is the farthest over is Joel Wiley. He's a member of the Board of Directors, Western Region of the Certified Crop Advisors Association. And Jackie Vasquez, she's the operations director at Sundance Berry Farms. Today, some of the objectives of what we're going to talk about, we'll touch these briefly so we can keep this moving, but we as agriculture believe that we need to work towards ensuring, that we have reasonable methods for farmers to account for the new nitrogen. Because there was a question, I'd like to just address right now. New nitrogen to agriculture, it's what the farmer does, what he controls. It's his fertilizer, in short. It's our management, okay? The farmer cannot dictate at what level, how much nitrate is pumping out of his well at any time. He has to react to it. The decisions the farmer makes are centered around new nitrogen. Nitrogen that's in the soil and the water is already there. He's just working with it. So when we talk about changing behavior at the soil surface, that would be the farmer's decision how he fertilizes, which is new nitrogen that he's adding to the system. That's how I would explain it. Okay. We feel that there's a certain educational component to what we do, and it must center around the four R's, which we'll get into later in the presentation. We'd like to allow for the fact that if you look at the research, both the applied and removed data is showing improvement over time. We feel there's certain points that we will discuss that points of measurement, that we should focus on. That's both for, I believe, regulation and research. Obviously, we have a very diversified mix of crops on the Central Coast. Makes things very different here. We have a unique farming business going on, and then there's some management factors that we need to emphasize that minimize loading and which we plan to address. Obviously, the new thing with the ESJ decision of these coefficients, and how they fit into 4.0. And we would like to emphasize that there's some research involved. We have a lot of specialty crops around here for which there is not a lot of information available how to grow them. We would like to ensure that it's properly developed and there's a process involved for that if we are to be judged on our AR ratio. So I'll ask Joel to talk about the four R's, which is the first part of the presentation.
Thank you, Tim. So the four R's is an educational program developed by the International Plant Nutrition Institute, and it encompasses the review of, and it's really the four rights: the right source, the right rate, right time, and right place. Considering all of those factors in your decision making for applying crop nutrition, not necessarily nitrogen, but all nutrition. Right source would be taken into consideration for us would be, and today we're addressing nitrogen, is how do we configure a nitrogen solution, urea, ammoniacal, and nitrate nitrogen, blending it together to concur with plant nutrient uptake and using that chemistry and manipulating those nutrients to be more available to that plant at the time it's needed. Taking into consideration that source may encompass compost, even plant residues, when we're considering the decision-making process we're dealing with. The next 4R is the right rate. And considering the right rates, we're continually pulling soil samples at the beginning of the crop cycle, and then before most irrigation inputs, we're usually pulling a nitrate sample, which helps us have some predictability about the available nitrogen available to that plant and the rates of nitrogen to impact that plant growth at any one time. What's interesting is, though, in that plant, for example, lettuce, in that last 30 days of production, and you've probably heard this before, it takes up about 70% of its total nutrient. So trying to time that process and get the proper placement, which is another part of that 4R, is the right place, is very critical. The single-use drip irrigation system, or drip in general, has provided that tool to be absolutely much more accurate in your placement of nutrients and taking advantage of its solubility and movement to that plant. And then the last thing would be is the right time. And again, that's critical in timing with an irrigation input and cycle. The 4Rs is an educational program. I think in the Central Coast, we used to call it best management practice of cool season crops. It's been adopted 25, 30 years. There was a great UC publication that adopted this process a long time ago. Many countries, many nations come to California and the Central Coast to observe how we deal with the 4Rs. The 4R comes in a manual like this. And it's interesting, in this manual, there's not one vegetable crop mentioned. And this manual is a document that's traveled across the world. It's so rate, uptake, that type of thing. There's not any vegetable crop here. And that's the part of the research that I think is void, the data to relate to some of these obscure crops that we farm in the Central Coast.
Jackie's going to talk about this slide. It's a representative graph of a body of work from the UC and their head lettuce studies over the past many years.
If you can see, the graph represents lettuce yields from 1958 to 2017, and also pounds of nitrogen applied to over time. This is even before some of this was an issue and we had more awareness of this. The rates have decreased, nitrate rates have decreased, and yields have increased as an agriculture where nitrogen is not our only source of making our yields increase. It can't be for environmental reasons, for a lot of things. We've just developed new ways of having better BMPs, better efficiencies on the field, such as making sure plants are spaced correctly, making sure that you prepare the ground correctly, even water, how much do we water? How efficient is our watering? Variety development has been huge. to ensure that we don't have to put as much nitrate or nitrogen into the soil and still have an increase in yield, because that is our business. We need to make sure that we hit our yield marks to stay in business. So if you can see in this chart, we are getting better, and we're still keeping our part of the business alive.
Just to add a quick thing, there's a slight error in here. It's not the pounds of nitrate applied. That would be nitrogen. As Joel said, we take the form of nitrogen into account when we fertilize. Also, if you look, there's obviously data going back previous to 1976 or 7. But if you read the literature, the UC used to just tell us dollars and cents. That's the only factor. This is the best way based on money. The study here that we did starts with when they actually started saying pounds and talking about the actual agronomic usage. The point there is, at one time, it was an economic decision. It is no longer that. And the A to R stuff has improved over time as the focus changed. The people that advise us where we go to get information, they change as well. Our guidance changes over time. Okay, so for measuring use, obviously we all know the crops here on the coast. Cool season vegetables, which is by far and away the most diverse. We have berries, grapes, and orchards. The three points of measurement that we feel are important are the nitrogen applied, which, as I said, new nitrogen is the grower, what he does, his behavior. The nitrogen uptake by the crop, which is very important to note that you must grow an entire plant to harvest part of it. So we look at the uptake of the crop. There is more nitrogen involved in a farming system than just the harvested product. And then obviously the removal, what we do remove at harvest. And I think based on what you've started to hear here about research gaps and whatnot, the focus here needs to be for both common sense regulation and research, because as I mentioned, at one time, it was just an economic decision. We need research to take the next step forward and say, we are going to start more and more focusing on the fate of nitrogen in the environment. How is it in our farming systems? And we will have to follow the curve with the guidance that we get. There are no studies that I can find that will tell you, for example, some of you have been to our farm, the uptake of rainbow chard versus green chard versus organic dill, there's nothing there. We're trying our best to do what we can with the information we have, but the gaps are there. Okay, some of our practices that we employ on the farm that minimize loading. How to account for high nitrogen well water for irrigation. You just heard a lot about that. I think that's an important educational component when you start talking about outliers. The timing of your nitrogen applications, Joel spoke to that briefly. It is meeting crop demand with your fertilization decision. And then also matching your total end crop needs to the crop uptake. Some other factors that affect the entire system are denitrification, the coordination of your irrigation, that's especially at harvest time. As you heard, the grower just delivers the product to the harvester or the shipping company, if you will, and there's another decision there when it's handed off to the next link in the supply chain. And then obviously there's technologies that both fix and hold nitrogen in the root zone that prevent leaching that need to be studied more, and volatilization. This slide is just meant to show you what some farms actually look like. They're extremely diverse. Here you can see about probably 3 to 4 or 5 crops grown in sequence. It looks like the grower here is pretty much planted, the same crop maybe twice. So this might be one group that he harvests, then he moves on to the next one. But you see the same basically diverse cropping pattern over time. This will reoccur on a ranch over and over as you go down it. It's a subsequent week of harvest or maturity, if you will. Another shot of the same thing. You see right red right next to green. This is how it's pretty much done on the coast. And it gets to be very complex. We went ahead and came up with a hypothetical of what it might be like. Here's an example. It's a 200-acre farm. There's 20 blocks, 10 acres of each block. It'd be repeated throughout the season. The crops grown on each block is going to be somewhere in the range of 2 to 2.5 here on the coast. And then often you have more than one well with varying nitrate levels. Mark talked about blending of water. Often what a grower will do will start both wells and irrigate various plantings. The irrigation system is linked or looped, as we say. That allows the water to be operated at a proper pressure so that you can irrigate with the best uniformity that you can get. It's the most efficient way to do it. And in the end, when you consider this entire ranch, what the grower truly knows is how much water he put on the whole ranch, how much fertilizer and he put on the ranch, and then what his yield was. So whoever harvests his crop is going to tell him in either pounds or cartons what he got. So he knows what he took off, knows what he put on, and he knows the water. He may not have the coefficients, depending on what he grows, more often than not. With this many small plots, he's not going to have a coefficient. However, the important thing here is if you look at it on a ranch level, the grower has the information and he's collecting it. Some of you have been to our farm. Bruce, I know you were there. You saw where we might have one planting that's one bed. And an irrigation line or two lines together, in essence, irrigates three different plantings. And there's no way a grower can tell you that on this one planting of this plant, entirely different from the one next door, I put on this much nitrate from that water. But if you put it at the ranch level, he knows the total amount.
Tim, are you using ranch to equal farm? Is that synonymous?
What we would call a ranch is basically a single property. It can consist of various APNs, but for us, it's a farming unit.
But that slide says farm. You're speaking to ranch. They're the same thing?
Yeah, they can be.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. If a grower only has, like, one operation, Bruce, then he would call it a farm. That's my farm. Whereas one grower says, well, I'm a farm, but I might have various ranches. It all depends on size, and each operation is going to be unique.
So in this example, you're saying the grower knows how much water is applied to the ranch during the season. I'm assuming that those wells are separately metered, so he would probably know how much water was applied to the ranch from each of the two wells.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Correct. Yep. And therefore, he can, you know, make his decisions from there. It is possible to separate the wells on some ranches to allow yourself to apply the proper amount of water. Generally, there'll be a gate installed that you would lock down and separate it. But if a grower's going to apply the exact same amount of water to two fields, he'll loop them together. And often the goal there is to achieve a higher uniformity so he can get the pressure just right and utilize the proper amount of water. If you look at the way wells are constructed, to irrigate a well that runs at a constant flow and choke it down to water less acreage, it becomes a highly inefficient operation. So we try to aggregate water on the ranch to keep our efficiencies high.
This is another slide on tracking UN, which seems to be the topic. It's basically reaffirming things that we had already mentioned in terms of growers. We use water for germinating seeds or for establishing plants. And if we're using high-end groundwater and we have to use it against us, it's just not a good business for us. And so we're asking for you guys to incentivize and not penalize us using water in that practice. And after the plant is germinated and after we're using it for our regular fertilization, then we can start counting it as additional N. But so track the new N, but everything we use in terms of a high-end groundwater well to germinate or to establish plant, to have it not be counted against us.
Okay, this is a simple slide that basically shows you outliers, how they would be determined. We believe that the best way to educate people change behavior at the soil surface and improve water quality is to control what we can control, and that is our decisions and how we farm. And obviously within the regulated community, you're going to have some outliers, some people that are both good, bad, middle of the road. It's a standard bell curve. This is just simply designed to show that there may be, depending on how you put the axis on this graph, both good and bad operators.
This is a slide that was presented before to you guys. We're just using it as a point of reference to, for example, highlighting in the strawberries, the one-to-one index of uptake versus and removed in a strawberry plant, for example, is not possible. The most we could expect would be a 2.6 to a 1 in terms of the pounds of N uptake or uptook, and then the pounds of N removed at time of harvest. So in something like a strawberry, which we're highlighting here, 1-to-1 ratio is just impossible. We can't make it.
Okay, this is TNA data from the records in 2015. They basically show nitrogen from fertilizers and amendments only. And if you look here, obviously there's a higher end to the graph. This highlighted area represents 16% of the graph. Therefore, if you look, the majority of the people are somewhere within the range of what we call a good or average performer, and the outliers would be obviously to the higher end of the scale. But this right here represents the 16%. And then as you look over time, this is 2016, the curve has shifted to the left. The goal here would be obviously to take the outliers and move them to the left. And by concentrating on them and their practices, we believe that we can improve water quality by basically changing behavior of the soil surface.
Can I ask you a very brief question with that slide you have? The average growers in the 2016, which is the top one, it's between 200 and 260 pounds per acre, correct?
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see sometime this week, that we need to get it down to around 30, I think. Or is it a different 30 that I'm getting mixed up, John? That it's good that it's shifting to the left, but I guess the point I want to make is it true that it needs to shift a lot more to the left for runoff objectives to be met and groundwater leaching to be met?
I think that's an accurate statement. I think Tim's speaking, though, to where to start and how to implement, let's say 4.0 in this case.
Right. So I'm just pointing out what I think, if I'm not mistaken, is a big elephant in the room, that what you're saying is 100% accurate. We want to move things to the left, and it seems to be happening. What do we do if we have to still move it a whole bunch more to the left? If it's true, we have to move it a whole bunch more to the left.
Is that where the 30 came from that you mentioned? Because that's where you lost me.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't know if my 30 is correct.
Right. So actually the 30 you reference is a reference to a number in the UC Davis report, Dr. Harder's number. Using it here in this context probably isn't it is a number established. It probably isn't totally appropriate. We'll talk about that more in November and March. But circling around to the gist of what you said, yeah, that is accurate, that over-application is occurring, and exclusively focusing on the current population of outliers won't fully remedy the, for example, the drinking water beneficial use. We have to focus on more than just the outliers.
Okay, and obviously,
just so everybody in the room isn't wondering what this mysterious 30 is that's going to be unveiled in November. The numbers we're looking at here our total application. If I'm not mistaken, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Robinson, or Mr. Robertson, the 30 was a number from the Harder report application over in excess of uptake that was a baseline for what could go, what could be applied without increasing the loading to groundwater above the drinking water standard. So it is, we're sort of comparing strawberries to oranges here.
Right. Okay. And that was actually a much more elegant articulation than what I gave. So I appreciate that. I also want to mention that we did discuss this as part, the Harder report and the reference to the number, we did discuss this in some level in the May 2018 board meeting. So it's not like it's a big mystery that's going to be revealed. We'll just discuss it again in the future.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, so the State Water Board, okay, has mandated some outliers, and we're here today, and we're obviously talking about that. As you know from the ESJ deal, there is an expectation that outliers need to be determined and reference ranges. They have a multi-year ratio. And target values developed by a third party in the Central Water Board. They also think that data collected by a third party, right, indicates that different methods of assigning outliers may be needed as different crops are considered, which I think we all can pretty much see that here on the coast, we have many, many very different crops. So while some crops may cover a wide swath, there is no single approach probably that's going to accomplish that for this region. Okay, we talked a little bit about ratios. I glossed over it briefly in the opening remarks, but the coefficients, right, should be approved by you guys in consultation with the state board, but there's obviously some research that's going to have to go on to develop some coefficients for some of these crops that we're growing here on the coast. We also believe there should be a way for us to account for the different ways that our product is reported back to us in harvest. I think on our field day we touched on it, but some guys are told we took this many cartons out of your field. Some guys are told we took this many pounds. It varies greatly, and so it may have to be adapted, quite frankly, to the situation at hand. We may pack lettuce 100 different ways. We may grow it for pounds and cartons. That comes back to us. There will need to be some way to account for the different ways it's reported. The grower is often just told by the shipper, this is what I took off your land. Okay, so research. For N removed and the best application rate to maximize nitrogen in the harvest. We feel that the research is focused on maximizing yield and the cost of inputs. As I referenced from the graph, it's transitioned more to the place we are now, which is, I believe, going in the right direction. But new research would be extremely helpful for us, to address the minimizing of N applied while maintaining yield and quality. So, what's the best number? How do you get there in each and every situation? The research has to take into account the different factors, and you heard in the previous panel that things from King City to Castroville are very different, and that's going to hold true for the fertilizer as well as the irrigation water. And so, we can get there, but it's going to take a little bit more help, I believe. There are some climatic differences, production complexities that are involved, and we've touched on some of them, but oftentimes when you talk about the grower, the removed portion of the equation is out of his control. There are times when you completely grow a field and it never gets harvested. Okay, I can tell you right now, if there's a food safety outbreak going on, you're going to disc product. And you've grown it the way you're supposed to. Okay. How do you account that there will be zero R for that particular field? And I can promise you agronomically that's a huge hurdle for CCAs to overcome.
Doesn't it also occur at times that when the market for a given commodity is in the toilet, that the shipper says, has the right to tell the grower, we're not harvesting this field, and the grower is contractually has no choice in that?
Correct. I just picked a food safety scare as one of many examples.
Sorry, how frequent is that, though? Is that nominally, or is it a relatively regular and frequent occurrence?
For example, in a strawberry business, it doesn't even happen. Sometimes we experience labor shortages, so we fall behind in a field, and by the time we get caught up, that product is not worth picking. So we're forced to leave that field and disc it. So this isn't even – it's not a market. It's not a food safety. So it happens for a lot of different reasons. More and more, it's becoming more popular, or something that we're forced to do for different reasons.
Right. I understand that there's multifarious reasons, but I'm just asking for maybe a quantification, or is
pretty frequent nowadays.
Okay,
but I don't know first.
It's been my impression it is impossible to predict the market. That's why farmers are price takers. We grow it on good faith that it'll be good when we get there. It's out of our control. Okay, this slide is designed to represent some of the tools we have. If you look here, this is for almonds. I'm sure it was selected because of the ESJ order has a lot of, there's a lot of almonds over there. But anyway, if you look at the yield and the demand and the fertilizer required, this is pounds. Here's your demand. Here's your amount required to get that. I'm sure they're factoring what it costs, what it takes to grow a whole tree, to harvest the nut, and what have you. But they have both per acre and per yield guidance on this. And if you look at lettuce, all you get are the rates. There's no harvested deal. This is the exact same prep stuff. It's just sometimes the grower can't get the information he's looking for. That's what it's designed to show. Okay, so our objectives today, just to circle back and end it, reasonable methods. We went over that, how we discussed that at the ranch level, or parcel level, if you will. We know the water we put on. We know the fertilizer we put on. We can get from whoever took our product what was removed. We can use those things to account for the nitrogen at the ranch level. We feel that education, especially for outliers, should definitely include and be centered around the four R's. We know we're improving. We're continuing to improve more. Things are headed in the right direction. I think on the horizon, as the research comes, my personal belief here, I think agriculture at the right time of the crop stage can be a net user of the water and soil nitrogen, which is old nitrogen. I think that's doable, and I think you can demonstrate it. The 3 points of measurement to focus on we went over, and we'd like to make sure that in 4.0 we take into account all the different crops, some workable system that works for the agriculture on the land here. It's very, very different than other parts of the state, obviously. We'd like to address, incentivize all management factors that minimize loading. We have a plan and a reporting structure that is provided for under your guidelines. And we want to make sure that when we start getting into the nitty-gritty of AR, that the coefficients are scientifically derived, properly derived, and there's a public process for coming up with them, because we really feel it's going to affect what happens to us. And it's new, so we think it should be done properly. Okay, with that, are there any questions?
Not a question. Supplemental comment in my part. You know, we had these, short questions pertaining to crops that would not be harvested. And the question was, is it, can you quantify it? But there is definitely an increase of economic pressures in some case not to harvest because of the price point that's being provided, and somewhat counterintuitive that when you have an ideal growing season, it's not necessarily the best because yet then you do have a surplus. When you have a very challenging year with a very wet spring, you can get a better price. So these variables are also climatic related, and the point pertaining to labor shortage definitely cannot be underestimated, because here most of the presentation is on row crop. Well, this is occurring with wine grapes, and Mr. McIntyre probably would support that comment. There's been crops that had to be left on the vines because of the labor shortage. And the labor shortage here dictated by some extreme climate where all of a sudden you have major heat wave and your breaks is in 26.5. What are you going to do? So I do agree that labor increasingly has a role to play in how you can efficiently, plan your crop and have it properly balanced. Lastly, even with citrus, sometime it's a matter of coordinating with the East Coast. Florida is another big state of citrus growers. So sometime in trying to play the commodity market between the prices in Florida and the prices in California, you try to delay in order to be not to simultaneously have crops on both sides of the coast. So the economics, do take quite a significant role in your agronomic decisions that you made. I just wanted to further support that input you made. Thank you. So I'll start on my left.
Just one hopefully quick question to Tim. You ended, Tim, talking about research needed for coefficients. Do you hope that we don't go there at all in having some quantifiable coefficients that are targets in the 4.0? And second brief question is, how long do you guess the research might take until you might be satisfied that it addresses the realities that you face?
I have no idea how long all the research would take. I do think that a good process of how to adopt them, make sure they were developed with science. I mean, I've tried to go and look at stuff, and I can go to the USDA website and plug in some pounds, and the computer spits me out one number, and then I go read a UC paper by Tim Hartz, and I work through the percentages that he, and I get two different numbers. But they're both from a trusted source, in my opinion. But I think that's where, if you have a coefficient that can be agreed upon through a proper process that everybody can live with, then you use that. But how long it would take, I'm not a gambling man. I wouldn't venture it yet.
Thought you were a grower.
I am. That's the pace of university.
Mr. Young?
Thank you. Could we go back to the slide that's titled Strawberry Records 2016? So I just want to understand what we are seeing here in this trend. And so what I'm taking in comparing the 2015 to the 2016 records is that growers are becoming more educated and knowledgeable about their use of nitrogen, and they're modifying their practices so that we're seeing this shift to the left in the 2016 records and data. Is that fair?
I think that's what's going on. There could be a lot of things. This is fertilizer and amendments only. Strawberry growers are very transient. You could have had simply a good number of growers move on to a ranch that has higher nitrated water and they fertilize less. Right now, I'd say it's going to shift left. They're all going broke and they can't afford fertilizer, but that's just the year we're in. There's a lot of factors, but I do think you are correct that growers are getting better because the focus has turned to this over the years. And so people are realizing as it's harder and harder to compete, I should utilize, once my plant is at a stage it can utilize any nitrogen I do have in the water, I better be using it to stay in business.
So that we're not making any assumptions about what's causing the shift, do we know why it is shifting?
I think there's more awareness. I definitely think you see growers talking about it more. I know I hadn't, when I started, people would apply what they thought they had to apply. There wasn't really much process to it. And now, because there's awareness, because we know there's an inherent problem, people are aware. They're getting themselves more educated, hiring experts to come to their fields to have these conversations, really looking at what plant varieties per block, per just environment that you're in, growing environment that you're in, to make sure that you apply what's necessary to that plot, not specific to just what you think that area needs. So I do, to answer your question, I do think growers are getting smarter and getting help in areas that they might not be well educated in.
Okay, thank you. My next question has to do with looking at the data and this curve that we have. Some ranches are succeeding at a much less application rate than others. Are the ranches that appear to the left of this curve, to the left of center of this curve, do they represent a certain type of location or soil type or climate regime? Or is there a mix?
I would guess a mix, but without knowing, I could say that who would know the guy putting on 40 to 60 pounds if he had any yield? You don't know.
Yeah, that.
I mean, maybe
no
he
yield.
Abandoned his crop halfway through the year and he had to report what he did and that was it. You don't have enough information here to really.
And I think that's my point. I think that would be helpful, you know, for us, because if we're looking at mm-hmm. numbers and targets and what's the right range, and already, you know, we're seeing the use shift just in a couple of years, I'd really like to know more about the data on the left side, and is it representative of a cross-section of those factors that you have been raising in terms of where we get variability? Soil types, climate, temperature regimes, things of that nature, evapotranspiration. So,
well, I think these are points, Mr. Young, that, you know, it's our staff, we shoot this slide, and
it is to Chris, maybe.
Yeah, so I think
that.
In fairness for, you know, our speakers, this data was generated by our staff, and I think perhaps as we continue gathering more information and educating ourselves about what is happening, our staff can further zoom in on some of these. But, you know, I don't think the answer can come from our speakers. I mean, it's a very valid question.
Yeah,
but
well,
I would put the question back to our staff.
Basically. Yeah, the question is meant to go out there. I'm not expecting anyone on the panel to know, but if we don't ask the question, we're not going to get an answer from somebody at some point in time.
I think I'll add to that. I think we also need to be patient, that we're hungry to draw conclusions, and we need more years of this. And as Tim references, we need to understand a little bit more depth of maybe why is that farmer on the left, you know, to Tim's point.
Right. But we do have that information in the database.
You'd have to ask somebody. I can get an answer to that, but I don't have that answer.
Well, at least in terms
of staff.
At least in terms of location?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, for each ranch on that graph. Yes.
Okay.
Succinctly put, each farm has its own story. Right.
Okay, and so let me move to my right. Thank you.
So I have a question regarding the for both panels, technical advisory committee was suggested. My short question is, will this be discussed over the course of the day? Will other panels refer to ways in which these different issues can be better informed with a standing technical advisory farm group to the regional board? Or is this the time to ask, what do you have in mind? What are you proposing? Because I heard that from, I believe, Jocelyn mentioned that as a potential workaround or solution, if you will, to having the opportunity to probably work more closely with the kind of ultimate information that we hear during the hearing, and which we learn sometimes during the hearing, sometimes later, that the expertise we're relying on is missing information, gaps in research that are not perhaps being articulated or not clearly enough, that where the gaps fall in terms of where we are now in our understanding. We have to have a baseline. We have to have information. We have to use the information we have. So I think we're doing a good job of that, and I think we're that as data accumulates over time, we're better informed. And I think we would always agree that more research is always the answer. That's not unusual to hear, and I'm glad to hear that farmers are also seeing that as new information comes forward, that we're all aware that things are changing all the time. So the short question is, are we going to hear more about technical advisory potential for being involved as we go into 4.0, or is this something for the morning session only?
I don't think we planned on proposing one today. I think Jocelyn thinks it's a good idea. I happen to sit on a TAC with her, and I think they're a great way to develop and disseminate information, and it would, you could have staff from the regional board plus industry together working to solve these problems, and I think that's a collaborative entity, and I think that's what she was thinking there.
Yeah, plus in terms of the timetable, then later on, next board meeting, there will be more details about some of the concepts of the ag order, which then will provide the opportunity for more specific inputs to each of the modules that are being proposed. So where we are here today is just really the beginning, and not diving into, in 4.0 we should do X, Y, Z. So I think it kind of highlights a little bit, some of the broader questions that are going to have to be addressed. But the intent today is not to start debating right, either from our board viewpoint and also from the speakers, what 4.0 needs to look like. And from my perspective, I really appreciate, by the way, the information, the way you present it. It's very valuable for this board.
Yeah, my point was just to clarify for myself where it sits in terms of the perspective coming forward today. It's a new important component, and so just want to take note of it.
Thank you. Ms. Gray.
I'll be brief. I also was interested in the technical advisory committee. I have plenty of experience with groundwater sustainability planning, tax. Those are Always very informative, so great idea there. And I'm happy to hear that there's been behavioral and cultural changes related to the bioavailability of nutrients in the soil and water, so that's wonderful. I applaud everybody's efforts in embracing that. And just had a question, and I don't know if you can answer or not. Also happy to hear that you're interested in research. Is anybody on the Central Coast actively involved in research pilot projects or anything that you know of? Any growers that are active in?
Oh, yeah, over the years we've all done something. I mean.
Mm-hmm. And so would you be interested in doing something further on these research? Okay.
We've worked with them before.
Okay, thank you.
And we're interfacing with Michael Kahn right now on a celery trial for uptake and irrigation practices. Right. In fact, he just called me a minute ago.
Great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can also state that in the grape growing sector, there's quite a bit of work being done by UC Cooperative Extension, for example.
So we could expect to hear some of those outcomes, I would imagine. Great. Thank you. Thanks for your presentation.
Mr. Johnson?
Yeah. Back to new nitrogen. And, you know, I've heard from a couple of members of this panel and the previous panel that it doesn't make sense to count that nitrogen in irrigation water if it's in field prep or germination stages. And my thinking is, going back to your Epiphany Farms example, where you're growing a whole series of crops on 10 fields on a ranch, or 20 or however many there were, over the course of a year, and realistically, you know how much water was applied, let's say, from each of the two wells, and maybe you're making an assumption or maybe you're testing the water over the course of the year so you even know how much nitrogen was in that water at different times. But it would strike me that because you're growing sequentially, you don't necessarily know how much water was used for field prep and germination, and how much of that water was used for, I guess you might. You would?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'm intrigued by the concept of not counting water used for germination in field prep where no uptake is possible, not counting the nitrogen in that water. But I'm also aware that we already require complex reporting of farmers. And I'm cautious about things that would make that reporting that much more complex, and I'd just like your comment on that.
So when you factor that in, you know how many rough inches of water, if you speak in that language, you put on at the mm-hmm. phase. Your management is going to take into account that your applications can be supplemented by nitrate in the water if the crop is at the stage that it can utilize it. So then you know what you're going to put on. You may not know exactly what it is in the water, but you can get fairly close. I mean, maybe someday it's real time. It's not there now, I promise you. But you can get close enough to where you can say, okay, anecdotally, if I need 100 pounds and my total crop, I put on 80. 20 pounds came from the soil and the water that I don't control. I used it. Now, based on the situation and where you are, it may have come from the soil in one end of the valley, it may have come from the water in another, but you know you used it because you put on less than what that crop needs. So when you manage, we don't fertilize with nitrogen when we're germinating because the crop can't use it. Joel mentioned the last 3 weeks of a harvest for like a lettuce crop. That's when we're doing it. And on a high nitrate water source, you would use less. On a water source that has zero, you would put what the crop needs. So that'll inherently be taken into account on your management.
I'm talking about the reporting more than the management, because part of what we are legally required to do is the reporting aspect, so that we can actually document what's going on. And I realize that's hard when you guys don't even always know what's going on. But I guess that's my question. If we were to try to separate out reporting on nitrogen in water during germination and field prep and nitrogen in water during the rest of the crop cycle. Is that actually functional? Is that actually doable from the farmer's end in terms of the reporting requirements?
And then you All take right. it into account when you come up with the ratio.
All right.
Of what's
so,
acceptable.
Thank you. So at this time, two choices, a break right now, or we give Chris less than 5 minutes to answer the questions that we had earlier about nitrogen applied, and that way this whole item is finished, and we move on to the topic of toxicity. What's your pleasure?
Go with the second option.
All right. So, Chris, no timer needed. Yeah.
Thank you. Chris Rose with the Water Board. I think the question was, what is new nitrogen? And I believe our panelists answered the question, unless you have further questions about that.
My further questions would be for you to explain to us from your perspective whether you agree with their concerns about being punished for double counting or for using high nitrate irrigation water.
I'm really not prepared to answer that question today. I think that's something that we should be talking about in November and March.
Does it need further research?
I'm sorry?
Does it need further research? Just kidding.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I think we're getting into the weeds about what we could be doing in Ag Water 4.0. We're just, that's not what today is about, with all due respect.
Yeah. And we don't want to put too much fertilizer on weed either.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. So what you're saying is today is for information primarily from the public, stakeholders, et cetera, and it's not for delving into the details on various concepts.
And getting staff response today. Yeah, I just
– Okay,
again,
I respect
with all due respect.
Yeah. You know. Yes, thank you very much.
And also, in the spirit of today and tomorrow.
Yes.
What we reflected on, Mr. Robertson and myself, is to make today – your day for agriculture and tomorrow, the NGO and environmental groups' days, and keep our portion, minimal. Of course, I think there's value of gleaning information like you're doing, but this is your meeting, so we don't want to take too much away from that.
And frankly, what people here today may change not only the board's opinions, but it may impact staff's opinions. So it's fair to, I think, to have this be a listening day for all of us.
Yep, agreed.
So I just wanted to affirm what Bruce said, and that is, I think there's a bit of a conundrum there, that we do want groundwater to be used. Looks like there's a challenge there. If there is no uptake of nitrogen during certain times of the year when it's being applied, I just would like to hear back when you come back to us on this issue, how staff has thought about that and how that dovetails into whatever plan you're going to be coming back to us at in terms of what the order might contain in it. So, I would like to see some consideration of that.
And
that's what Bruce said. I'm just affirming what he said.
And I would say, not to make this comment a directive for staff. I think everything that's being discussed right now in questions, staff is taking notes of this, and that's all going to be part of, the staff learning portion. So. I would hope that it's not just this singular item, but all the other ones we talked about, crops that have to be left on the field and all these other unknowns. So thank you. So at this time, let's reconvene at 11:15 after a break. Thank you.